Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. Thanks for joining us today. We have a great conversation ahead. A couple of conversations, actually, today. What does technology have to do with a Lutheran day school? What kind of technology is used in the classrooms? What technology is ideal for the classrooms? What can you expect this year for your child in a Lutheran day school? We're going to talk with Matt Burkhold from the Lutheran's Office of National Mission Lutheran Schools, and we'll talk with him in just a little bit, and we'll also talk with Reverend Dr. Terry Dittmer from Office of National Mission Youth Ministry about the next generation. What is this next generation? You know, we've heard of boomers and millennials and things like that. What is this next generation called? We're going to talk with Reverend Dr. Terry Dittmer from Youth Ministry here at the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod about that today as well. Hope you can join us for that conversation. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting this program. To find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin, just go to our website, kfuo.org, and look for the sponsor section. And there you'll find the CUW logo. Click on that, and that'll take you to their page. You can find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin at kfuo.org in the sponsor section. Joining me in studio today, Matthew Burkhold, coordinator of online support and services in the Office of National Mission, specifically school ministry. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us in studio today. It's good to have you here, recently joining the staff here at the International Center. Matt, thanks for being our guest.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
So tell us a little bit about your work as the coordinator of online support and services in school ministry.
So the position itself really looks at technology in Lutheran schools and working with all the different aspects from the school ministry standpoint. So with all the Lutheran schools in the country and coming up with ways to communicate, to collaborate with them, the position itself is kind of a new position, taken some cues from other positions in the past and had needed a little refinement. So we went through and looked and saw what was needed. The director of schools, Terry Schmidt, kind of put that position together. So for me, I'm really looking right now specifically at a few of the existing programs that we do, things like the Lutheran School Portal, some of the work that we do with the NLSA accreditation process, and taking those and moving them forwards into the 21st century and really bringing people together and bringing them online, more importantly, through both of those. My day-to-day, I really look at a lot of the portal stuff right now, the upkeep, the maintenance, some of that moving forwards. Working with the NLSA process right now, like I said, a lot. We're taking the existing structure that we had been working with, which was paper and binders and all sorts of mailing processes, and digitizing it, making sure that all of our schools can submit online. We just went through kind of the approval process for all of that, and that's going to be rolling out here in the near future. So,
all right, you used a bunch of terms that some of our listeners might not be familiar with, so we'll break down some of those here in just a little bit. And we're going to talk, we've talked about accreditation here on Faith and Family before, but we'll talk about some of those things, accreditation, the accreditation website and the portal and stuff like that. We'll talk about that briefly here in a little bit. Before we get to that, give us a little bit of your background. How did you get to this place? How did you end up here? Do you have an education background?
I do. I was a sixth grade homeroom teacher in Orlando, Florida, at Trinity in Orlando for 6 years. I had 6, 7, 8 social studies, 7, 8 math. Oh, a few other random odds and ends in there as well, as always happens when you're teaching. And by the end of that, I was also director of technology. So I'd kind of worked into that as well. I really didn't know that I wanted to start there. Coming out of Concordia River Forest with a dual in education and history. I student taught at the secondary level at high school, and really didn't know about the tech part. So classroom teacher there in Orlando. And then the position opened up at St. Luke's in Oviedo, where I ended up next doing, it was officially classroom technology instructor. So I was working with teachers, more importantly, throughout the year to do in-services and trainings based on their need, what they could use to integrate technology into the classroom. Along with that, did some design work for a STEM lab, science, technology, engineering, and math. So a lot of the different pieces and parts that went into that as well. So
really, through experience, you started off as a history teacher primarily, but through experience and out of necessity for the use of technology in schools, you really started learning these things through your experience and work. And so here you are today as someone who's gained this knowledge and this experience kind of firsthand from your work in Lutheran schools, now supporting others. Let's go back and talk about some of those other things that you mentioned along the way. Accreditation, National Lutheran Schools accreditation process. In the past has required lots of forms. Accreditation requires lots of paperwork, lots of forms. And this is really kind of a behind the scenes thing for many schools. A lot of people don't realize how accreditation plays a role in schools. And we've included a conversation. We've talked with Terry Schmidt and Dr. Paul Philp about what accreditation means for Lutheran schools. And so understanding that accreditation is an important part of your child's education. It may not necessarily mean a whole lot to you if you just hear those words, but the fact that a school is accredited means that that they followed they meet a certain standard. So for schools to go through this whole process to be accredited takes a lot of work, a lot of paperwork, a lot of time. The website and the resources that you mentioned earlier, the being able to do this online, how does that help schools?
Right. So in the past, kind of the process that the schools would go through was you would go through an annual process to reevaluate yourself and look at what you were doing for accreditation. And then it had been either between 5 or 7, depending on what year cycle you were on. You'd have a team that would come in and would look at your school, look at your practices, look at everything, manuals, handbooks, etc. And for them coming in, they would always have to hunt for stuff or that schools together would put everything together. You'd binders and there'd be a crate and all sorts of different things when you rolled in as an accreditation team that they'd hand you this box and say, okay, here's all our stuff. Now go look at our students. So you kind of had to do a lot of that in advance. The hard part for your visit team and for anybody who was looking to do the actual accreditation process was that you couldn't share any of the information. If it wasn't digitized or electronic, it was in paper form, if you had a manual or handbooks or whatnot. So for a group to come in advance, they couldn't really look at any of the stuff prior to them them coming to the school. So in terms of a logistical standpoint, being able to have all of that online that all of your visit team members and everybody else could look at is huge. It really allows the teams to get a much better understanding before they step foot in the door of kind of the nuts and bolts, the behind the scenes stuff that you really don't have to worry about too much. Just make sure they've got it, it looks good, and moving on. The other side of this is that with some of the new accreditation processes that are going through, it's a lot of evidence-based. So schools are being asked to show, what is it that you're doing that proves that you're actually educating students, kind of thing. So for the schools themselves, they can now, they'll be able to, when we implement this completely, upload videos and links and all sorts of different media that shows what their teachers are doing, what they do. If they do an event, they can, sound clips or audio clips for all sorts of different evidence-based activities that actually show, yes, they're accrediting. Because if you have a team that rolls in and can't see any of it going on in the classroom, you really don't get that full picture from a one-day or two-day visit. But this allows schools to really show what it is that they do and do best.
So this can kind of streamline the process for accreditation to some degree. And as we mentioned earlier, this is one of those behind the scene things that it impacts the day-to-day things in Lutheran schools, but this is really something that parents and students don't necessarily deal with. It's what the educators and the administrators deal with each year on an annual basis. So it's a behind the scenes sort of thing. Another thing you mentioned was the Lutheran School Portal. This is a resource for administrators, for teachers. How is that used?
Right. So the portal itself was kind of designed as this place that Lutheran teachers and administrators could go for resources, for videos, for webinars, paperwork that was needed from the administrative level, from the synodical level as well. So it started from there. It's also the place where the forms that teachers and educators, Lutheran educators, fill out. It's kind of an informational form if you're ever going through the process to be called as a teacher. That's where some of that information lives.
The Lutheran Educator Information Form, IBA-DCE, I've filled those out before.
There you go. So that's where it lives. That's kind of the place where all of that has been.
10 pages.
It is. It's the last page that always gets you with all the open-ended questions and that nobody ever fills out. So a little shameless plug there to have people fill those out. So that's one of the places where that information would live. So you've got the LEAF form, you've got the different information for teachers and administrators. And over the years, some of the functionality had kind of been lost with some of the changes in technology, with what schools are needing, what they're wanting, and then just moving forwards with that to really make it a collaborative space. So for me right now, it's, like I said, the upkeep on that and making sure that there's the information that's out for teachers. We do a monthly mailing out to schools with all sorts of different resources. The first one is in paper form just to keep everybody on. And then after that, it goes to an electronic form if you're subscribed to the portal. Beyond that, you've got all sorts of different resources for administrators because of different programs like the SLED program. And accreditation itself is on there as well for some of the forms. But moving forward, it's definitely looking to really...
it's one of those websites that, because I'm not involved in a Lutheran school on a regular basis, it's one of those that I have to change my password almost every time I visit because I can't remember my password because I'm not there that frequently. But I understand for school administrators and for teachers, they probably use it pretty frequently. Again, one of those behind the scenes type things. Let's go to the classroom now as an educator and your experience. Tell us about your philosophy on the use of technology in the Christian day school. What you've shared with us your history as a history teacher and a homeroom teacher, and then how you started using technology and helping others use technology in the classroom. What's your approach to technology in the Christian day school?
It's a good question. I actually have been going out and working with schools. That's another kind of aspect of my job as well, and doing in-services and whatnot. And I had done a lot of that in the Florida, Georgia district when I was in Florida with educators conferences, et cetera. Through all of that and through working with all different schools, it's a little strange. You know, I kind of say to each his own to an extent. Each location has to come up with what's going to work for them best. And as an educator, you kind of have to go, what's going to work for me? What am I comfortable with? What's going to keep pushing me as well to be on that forefront? So in terms of technology, the integration of it into the curriculum is key, in my opinion, that if you're not comfortable with it, you still take those steps to move yourself into it. But it's not something where it's, you know, completely everything that you do. It still comes back to the teaching part. You know, people have joked that, you know, educators will be replaced by robots, but I don't see that happening because it's the teaching aspect of it that really still plays a huge role, especially in Lutheran schools, being the fact that you have the hands-on approach, as always, where it's going to still play a role for the learning, and it's what our students have. So you kind of have to meet them in that point, but still the empathy part of it with the students itself is huge. So
I think empathy and communication is something that's important that happens in those relationships that build that you don't build with a robot or a computer. You know, a student doesn't necessarily build that type of relationship with technology that they do with their teacher, with their instructor.
Right. But I do feel at the same time that it's an essential piece. Just looking at the world around us and what our students are headed off to, you know, as they move into high school, into college, and into the workforce, the skills that they need, we start them with. And that being the case, technology plays a huge role for all that they're going to do. So it has to be blended into the curriculum that might have been there for years. So.
What are some of the ways that you see technology being used? What are some of the ways that you've used technology as a teacher that you think are best practices, or that you've seen others using technology as a best practice in the classroom?
Right. There's a lot of different ones that I've seen going into a lot of different schools. And for myself, you know, really kind of pushing the boundaries. Everybody comes to see what I'm doing, usually when I was teaching, with different novel ideas or stuff like that. So for me, some of the stuff that I've seen is a lot of collaboration. I know I was a big proponent I am a big proponent of Google Docs and Drive in the classroom. It's a huge tool for schools, especially the fact that it's free, especially for Lutheran schools to use.
Or for Lutheran broadcasters.
So you've got a lot of tools in there. And for me, the biggest part of that was the collaboration part. You know, students could work on it. There's no longer, you know, oh, we've got a research project. Now, whose house are we going over to work on it? Now it's, you know, I'm going to sit at my computer and Johnny's going to go sit at his and Susie's going to go sit at hers. And we're all going to be in our own houses working on the same document all at once. So for me, just that collaborative aspect of it and all the different tools that came from that, you know, some of the Hangouts ideas where students could video chat with other teachers, other classrooms, things like that. Kind of along those lines, another one is Skype, a big use of that. Mm-hmm. Skype in the classroom is something that Skype itself has been pushing for educators. And they're doing something right now that I saw somebody doing. It's called Mystery Skype. You know, you don't know what classroom you're Skyping into or where they're at or anything about them. You have to guess what their situation is, what country they're in, what continent they're on, just with questions from the class itself. So that's kind of cool. That gets the students really to grasp onto, you know, critical thinking and mm-hmm. observation skills and history skills, et cetera. And then just the fact that they're talking with somebody who knows from India or from Japan. So that's one that I saw somebody using most recently. One of the most innovative aspects of technology right now in schools is kind of that STEM movement through science, technology, engineering, math. Some people throw arts in there to make it STEAM. So yeah, exactly. So you've got a lot of different aspects of that all being rolled into the curriculum together. So some cross-curricular ideas going on with, you know, makerspaces and 3D printers and robotics design labs and, you know, programming, all of that going in, visiting different schools that are starting up some of those programs, and myself kind of really pushing on one of those when I was back in Florida. So just a lot of the hands-on learning, especially mm-hmm. with that. But more importantly, no matter what you see a classroom or a teacher doing with tech, it's really, what are the students showing? What are they doing? You know, some of the accreditation processes go in and look and say, you know, what are the students doing? Are they learning? Are they involved? Are they engaged? You know, with this, what are you using tech to have your students show you? You know, are they making videos? Are they recording audio? Are they mixing their own music in a music class? Are they, you know, going through and doing all the different the production aspects of that? So really, is it, what is it you're allowing the students to show using technology as well? They're learning, more importantly.
So the technology itself isn't the matter of instruction, but rather using the technology as a means to teach something else, whether it be science, technology, engineering, math, the arts, even Bible curriculum or theology courses, humanities, things like that as well. You mentioned the, you know, using Skype to communicate with a mystery classroom on another side of the world or in another culture. So the technology is used to support education. It's not in and of itself the education. It's no longer technology. At one time was a subject and a discipline for some schools. It was you had math and English and technology, right. But now it seems so integrated in everything else in every aspect of education that it's not a course in and of itself.
Right, and sometimes there still is a time and a place for that. I know. It used to be, you know, in high school, you'd get a technology course or something like that, and they moved to middle school. And now we're finding, you know, we've had computers and Chromebooks and things like that in our mm-hmm. kindergarten classrooms, and the kids are able to grasp, you know, what it is. Yes, there's some times where you do still have to teach some of the technology, but the fact of it's just a tool. It's not mm-hmm. you're learning, you know, a technology curriculum. Your curriculum is infused with technology from day one.
So if we were to try to compare it to, you know, 30 years ago, this is a pen. It's right. Not a class on this is a pen.
Right.
This is,
you didn't have to learn how to use a pen. Cursive and stuff like that. Yeah. But once you learn the basics of it, you could run with it. So, you know, with our students coming into the classroom, they're rolling in with, you know, phones and tablets and everything mm-hmm. else that they have access to that we sure. don't need to teach them how to, you know, push a screen or punch a button. So it's the skills that they're going to learn because of, you know, the apps and the other programs that the teachers are utilizing enhance.
The things that they need to learn about the technology, they learn from their experience with the technology rather than having a course that's focused just on the technology.
Right.
What are some of the pitfalls that can accompany technology in a school? What are some of the things that can really be hang-ups that really could prevent a school from accomplishing what it's set out to do?
Right. That's always the question. You know, what don't we want to do wrong?
Or, what should we not install? What should right, we not or, purchase? Or, what should we not use?
Yeah, it's the one of those, what do we want to pass on to those from what we've messed up in the mm-hmm. past? I mentioned earlier that I do a lot of different in-services, and I was out visiting a few different schools recently and kind of working with schools of what they're trying to do. And, you know, by the end, they're like, oh, so we did this wrong. Yep. So a couple of the things, the biggest thing that I always see is don't go too far too quickly. As a school, you have to step back and go, okay, the existing curriculum works. We've been teaching kids with it. We're good to go. Okay, you want to bring in technology? Okay, where should we start? What kind of things do we need to look at first? Look at your existing curriculum and go, what needs to be modified? What do we want to change? And then figure out what kind of your non-negotiables are. What do we want to figure out? You know, we need to do this, this, and this with these different the types of curricular aspects. You know, for a science, it needs to cover X, Y, and Z. And then kind of go into, well, how do we train our teachers on what we're going to do? And that's the biggest part too, is the professional development for teachers. I go into so many different places that, well, have you done any training on this? No. Okay. So you're going to do this when? Oh, in 2 weeks. Okay. So really, really going, what is it that you're going to do for the teachers in terms of training and development? I know when we started a one-to-one program, so one device per each student, when I was at Trinity. The biggest thing that I said was, we're going to train everybody a year or two in advance. You're going to start working on this. So we started 2 years in advance looking at curriculum redesign. How is it that, you know, a one-to-one program changes your classroom? And then we put them through three online classes at Concordia, Wisconsin, based solely on education and technology, writing curriculum for a tech-based classroom, but then also, you know, what can you do in terms of ideas and bringing all that in? And then, so that was the first year. The second year, I said, okay, here's the device. After we did some device selection, you know, we chose Chromebooks and tablets. Here's the device. Go play with it. Learn it as teachers. And then that third year, it finally rolled into the classrooms that this is what we're going to do. So over those 2 years, the teachers were starting to pull stuff in their normal teaching curriculum. But mm-hmm. by the end of it, they were ready to go, okay, we're ready to go roll into this. So a lot of planning needs to go into it. It's not something, let's go buy, you know, iPads or tablets or computers and jump right in. It needs to have some serious thought.
For the teacher that might be a bit apprehensive about taking on this technology, having a plan like that to help roll it out, I'm sure, and the education for them along the way, the training for them along the way, certainly staff development would, I'm sure, be more welcome than just saying, here are a bunch of laptops, use them in your classroom, or here are a bunch of tablets, you should use them for all of your classes.
Right.
It can be a bit daunting.
It is. And you kind of see the look in those eyes who've kind of gone, oh, yeah, we walked into this backwards. But it really shows those that go through and do the planning process and the professional development. And it's that ongoing, you know, it doesn't stop when you end up with, you know, the curriculum. Oh, it's great. We're good to go. We all know how fast the technology scene changes, especially in education, with all the different tech startups for ed, that you really have to keep on it as a teacher moving forward. So
we've looked at this from the side of administrators and teachers. As for parents, what, especially having been a classroom teacher, what do you want parents to know as the school year is starting and maybe, you know, new technology being introduced? It might be technology their kids are familiar with. They might be familiar with in their household, might not. What do you want parents to understand about children, education, and technology in general?
There's a lot in there. You know, you're coming out of the classroom and seeing, like you said, firsthand, you know, what kind of things we would want, you know, parents to know in terms of technology or other aspects. I guess one of the pieces is, if your school is moving in the direction of technology, that's the way that they're going to go. The resistance doesn't help your students at all. We're not going to do that. Well, if your teacher's going to do it and the other rest of the class is going to do it, well, we're moving forwards. I don't want to say get on board, but, you know, have a conversation with the teacher and say, Hey, what's going on? Can you keep me better in the loop or stuff like that? And we as teachers are more than willing. Another part of that is, you know, if your school is moving forwards, you know, tech-wise, More often than not, they're going to communicate a lot more using electronic means, email, short little blasts out on different things. Go ahead as a parent and read all those. I know we take the time as teachers to put it all together, and, you know, schools especially, knowing a lot of different administrators, you know, they take the time to talk about if we're doing a tech program or things like that. Go ahead and read up on it just so that you're aware of it.
I mean, gone are the days of receiving report cards that are handwritten with grades
right.
in them.
Or whited out, you know, yes. something was wrong. Yeah.
I mean, now it's grades are all online. Parents can check them at various times throughout the year. It's not a every semester, every quarter, your parents get a handwritten report card that has, you know, notes from the instructor on it. They're typed notes, maybe, but it's all grades that are all online now. It's certainly a big change for education in general.
Right. All right. So I mean, that can be daunting for a parent who's not used to getting all that communication. But yeah, it's one of those things where you just kind of slowly work into it, and you'll be good to go. I guess one of the other things that comes to mind with parents and tech and students, more importantly, is one of the things that we always would see as teachers is your students have access to it, technology being it, all the time. Set limits on time, on place. One of the big things that we always worked with our parents when I was teaching was, you know, if it's a school device, if your school is blessed enough to have resources that the students are using, it's a school device. You know, it lives in a certain spot at home. You know, it doesn't live next to them at their bed at home. It lives, you know, out on the kitchen table. It plugs in there every night, so that you know that the time limits, your kid's not up till 2-3 in the morning, you know, talking with their friends. It's definitely a set aside device or set aside time or whatnot for the technology that's there. So I guess the limits it comes back to on all of that.
Yeah, being mindful of how it's being used at home.
Right,
just
when
as
and where.
Well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or away from home as well.
Right.
We've been talking with Matt Bertholdt, Coordinator of Online Support and Services in the Office of National Mission, specifically School Ministry. Matt, thanks so much for being our guest today and taking some time to talk with us about technology in Lutheran schools.
Of course. Thank you.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of inspiration in action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
The United Kingdom has been debating a law that would legalize doctor-assisted suicide. This should interest you because, like England, we now have socialized medicine with built-in incentives to deny patients costly treatment. Professor Theo Boer teaches at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. He's known for aggressively promoting euthanasia. But after personally seeing the carnage such laws bring, he's changed his mind and is speaking out against the UK bill. Professor Boer said these laws turn assisted suicide from a last resort into a normal procedure, and that it's become a default mode of dying for cancer patients. He laments he was terribly wrong to think euthanasia would work. He's right, and we must fight it here.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org. And stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Hi, I'm Andy Bates. I invite you to join me weekdays at 10 a.m. for Faith and Family, where we talk with experts and everyday people about topics pertinent to faithful family life. Weekdays at 10 a.m. on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news, underwritten by Concordia University, Wisconsin.
Finding just the right partner is a blessing when it comes to achieving God's plans. Hi, I'm Rich Robertson, President and CEO of the Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Before taking this position, I worked with LCEF in my home congregation. It was a joy to find a true Lutheran partner that understood our unique needs as we built a school and welcomed new families into our church and community. I hope you experience that joy too. Visit lcef.org to find out how your ministry can become empowered in its kingdom work.
Have you ever missed a live broadcast of one of your favorite KFUO programs? Well, let me propose a convenient solution for you. Visit the KFUO website, kfuo.org, and download your favorite program by way of podcast to your iPhone or other smart device. It's easy, it's simple, it's convenient, and you'll never miss another program. KFUO, the official voice of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, is the messenger of good news by way of radio, web, and podcast.
We live in a brave new world when it comes to infertility medicine, in vitro fertilization, embryo adoption, and assisted reproductive technology. What is the church to do? What comfort can we offer those suffering? LCMS Life Ministry and Concordia Seminary Life Team are sponsoring a free infertility ethics symposium for pastors, seminarians, commission ministers, and parish nurses, November 8th in St. Louis. Space is limited. lcms.org/life.
KFUO embracing today's technologies to bring the good news message of Christ to the world. Listening to worldwide KFUO on the go with your smartphone doesn't mean you have to walk around with earbuds all day. You can Bluetooth or sync up to listen in your car while driving anywhere. There are many easy ways to listen to worldwidekfuo.org. On the air, online, and on demand, the messenger of good news, Worldwide KFUO.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. Joining me in studio this morning, the Reverend Dr. Terry Dittmer, Director of LCMS Youth Ministry. Dr. Dittmer, welcome back to Faith and Family.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, Andy.
It's good to have you in studio again today and talking about important topics. And today, we're talking about generational history. Who is this next generation is the topic. What's next or who's next? Who is this next generation is the topic you mentioned recently in your blog on the LCMS website. And so let's talk about that. Let's talk about generational history. I know you're a fan and of generational history. You enjoy reading and studying generational history, as you mentioned in your blog. What is generational history?
Generational history is... It could possibly be blamed on the baby boomers. A lot of things could be blamed on the baby boomers. But we've always been identified as a generation. It's the post-World War II baby mm-hmm. boom when our moms and dads came back from the war and settled down, started having children, filled churches, filled malls, filled the suburbs, and... baby boomers basically filled the earth, and we're proud to tell everybody about how wonderful we were.
They took that Genesis command seriously.
Yes, indeed. So Neil Howe and William Strauss published a book called Generations, and they looked at as they saw it in the history of the United States, and ultimately, I think they're exploring the world. There are cycles to generational history has four cycles, basically. And there are four generational types. There's the idealist, characterized as visionary, individualistic, and spiritual. And that really defines baby boomers quite well, I think. Visionary, individualistic, and spiritual. So there's the idealists. Then the reactives, characterized as rebellious, pragmatic, and materialistic, or so-called Gen X. Boomers have never thought very highly of Gen X, and Gen X has returned the favor.
So there's kind of a wall or a divide between boomers and Gen X.
There can be.
A chasm.
There can be. Howe and Strauss wrote a really good book. It's called The 13th Generation. They tried to really put a positive spin on who Gen X was. They're the 13th generation since the founding of the United States. So that's a little bit more positive. But Gen X seems to be the title that's stuck. Then there's the civic generation, known for their heroic, collegial, and rationalistic attitude. This would be the so-called millennial generation that everybody's talking about these days. And then an adaptive generation characterized as conformist, sensitive, and cultured. That's the generation that has probably been being born over the last 10, 12 years. They're not getting a lot of play, but as I said in the blog, I think churches need to be, the church needs to be aware that there's this new generational type that's filling confirmation classes and Sunday schools and vacation Bible schools because they're not the millennial generation. Everybody's talking about the millennials, but that's largely because they've entered the economic stratus, part of our society. They're having a hard time finding jobs. They still live with their parents. They're not getting married. They're not having children. Or if they're having children, they're not necessarily married. So everybody's taken with millennials. I think we, and it's from the perspective of youth ministry, we need to look at this generation that's about to follow. They're much more collegial, collaborative. In theory, confirmation class, if you still do a traditional confirmation class, in theory, it'll be a lot easier to teach them. That's theory. and then the idea in Howe and Strauss's generation is that these cycle through.
That was my question. Do generations last a specific set amount of years? Like, is it 10 years, 12 years or something? How are generations determined?
Well, I remember in confirmation class being taught that a generation was 20 years. And there is no hard and fast rule, ultimately. Could be 18 years. It could be 22 years. Somewhere around the Civil War, and I forget which generation it was, Howe and Strauss have it down to like 14 or 15 years. So there's no hard and fast rule. But they did look and see that there was a cycle of generational types. The millennial generation sometime in the 80s started to be born. The reason that they were called the millennials is because the first millennials roughly graduated from high school in the year 2000. That's where they got their name. The baby boom was the baby boom, and now we have this new generation.
What was between the boomers and the millennials?
Gen X. Yes.
So we have boomers, Gen X, millennials. What's next?
Well, a whole bunch of proposals have been put on the collective table. There's the we generation, the regeneration, the digital generation, the I generation, or net gen. There have been a whole lot of possibilities. An organization called Magid Generational Strategies. So they're looking at how do we market, identify. The generations, they've taken it seriously, and they have proposed a name, and I'm guessing that it'll probably stick, the pluralist generation, or the plurals. And the idea there really is that this is the most diverse generation that we've ever had. In fact, they point out that I should have had this written down, but in about 2012, the ethnic composition of the United States will be 49.8% Caucasian. So it'll be the first time there's not a majority white population.
But that happened in 2012, or. That,
by 2012, well, yeah, 2 years ago,
yeah.
We were no longer a majority white or majority Caucasian mm-hmm. population. By 2012, the new generation mm-hmm. was 49.8% Caucasian. So this new generation that started to be born 12, 13 years ago, they've always been very diverse. By 2042, the population as a whole will be less than 50% Caucasian. So our kids are going to school, going to the mall, working in places where they're very aware that they're not just Caucasian folks running around, but they're African Americans, they're Asian. Hispanic population's about 24% in that generation. And they notice that. There are implications there as well for the church. Because when our kids go to church on Sunday morning, after having been to high school all week, they don't see the same diversity in their church that they see in their world. Hmm. So that's a whole mm-hmm. matter that we could discuss as well.
So as you said, they're going to school or work or other places where there is a lot of diversity when it comes to their peers, and they go to church, may not necessarily be the case. So that's something certainly should lead to discussions,
right?
Conversations,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And I would say in National Missions, which our youth ministry office mm-hmm. is a part of the Office of National Mission, we are looking at the varieties of places kids reside. So we've got rural and small town ministry. We've got urban inner city. How do we reach kids in those neighborhoods? Mm-hmm. We've only begun to scratch the surface. Hmm.
So this generation, they're called the plurals because what is that term rooted in here? I mean, when we hear pluralist, when a student of the Bible or a theologian hears plural or pluralist, ears might perk up and might be a little nervous.
It's the nature of the society in which they live. Mm-hmm. The diversity in the ethnic diversity is one aspect of that. Like it or not, the nature of the family mm-hmm. and how the nature of the family has changed. ARP magazine, I don't think I have that article with me, but ARP magazine pointed out the varieties of families that kids are coming from. There's still a few, believe it or not, families where kids reside with both their natural parents, but it's kind of frightening. Let's see if I get these numbers out of my brain. The average kid, 64% of kids in the United States live in two-parent families, but it's not necessarily their natural parents. Mm-hmm. That number's about 45% live with their natural parents. Good news for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, at the last National Youth Gathering, almost 78% of the kids at the gathering live with both natural parents. So we really buck that tide. But when a young person these days looks at the makeup of the family, there are intergenerational families where they live with their grandparents. There are gay families. There are mixed race family. I was trying to think of all the varieties of families, and each one has an issue or mm-hmm. a concern that identifies or sets them apart from family. We have to be aware of that, but that's a part of the diversity that the plurals take quite naturally. A mixed race family, for example, one of our natural parent families could have a best friend whose parents are two different races, And how do we attract or minister to those folks? Not that their needs are any different or their world's a lot different, but that's our kids just have that experience that maybe the church hasn't had yet.
Let's talk about the parents of the plurals. What are the characteristics of the plurals a result of the parenting style of their parents? You know, what was the generation, their parents, what generation are they in?
The theories now are that the current generation, so the plurals, are basically influenced by the parenting style of the boomers. The parenting style of Gen X. The millennials are influenced by the parenting style of baby boomers. What that means practically is that baby boomers basically parented with the idea that what's good for the group is good for everybody in the group. And so they really emphasize building relationships. And then at the end of the game, when everybody has succeeded, everybody gets a trophy. The current generation, the plurals, are influenced by the parenting style of Gen X, which tends to focus more on the individual. That's partly because the Gen X generation has, in some cases, in some ways, struggled to achieve anything. Part of that is the economy. Part of that is they just really weren't a wanted generation. One of the markers for the beginning of Generation X is 1964, when the pill became legal and people could make a choice not to have those kids. So that's the way Gen X began. Now they focus on the individual and how the individual can succeed. And at the end of the game, in that parenting style, the winner gets a trophy, but everybody doesn't. So
there's a difference, certainly, in parenting style from generation to generation, and that results in different characteristics of each subsequent generation, is
right.
What I'm hearing you say.
Right. And we can go into all the theories right now, but they are theories. And so you can see general kinds of trends, but they might buck the trend. The plural generation, the kids now, as an adaptive generation, a conformist, sensitive, cultured, but they don't make waves. I think it's interesting, historically, there was never a president of the United States from the last adaptive generation, now known as the silence. The closest we got to an adaptive president was Walter Mondale running for president, but he didn't get elected. So I think it's because they have a tendency to want to make everybody feel comfortable.
You mentioned adaptive. That's part of the different types or the different cycles of generations. Is that right?
Right.
What were those different? There were four different cycles. Is that correct?
Idealists, reactives, civics, and adaptives.
And so what were the boomers?
We are.
Are the boomers?
The idealists.
The idealists. The Gen Xers
are reactives.
And then millennials
are civics. And the other great civic generation was the folks that went through World War II who won the war. It's often been pointed out that civics and millennials have a lot in common. And theoretically, any generational type like that over the generations would have a lot in common. So the adaptive generation, known as the silence, and this new adaptive generation, known as the plurals, or probably known as the plurals, they'll have theoretically a lot in common, and so the pluralist will be peacemakers, collaborators. They'll work to make people comfortable, and probably won't raise a lot of issues. Unlike the baby boomers, we're all about issues. Anything that we're passionate about. You go back to the 60s and 70s, and it was the war in Vietnam, and feminism, and racism, and all kinds of isms. Those were the causes we took up. Then a jokester, I don't know who it was, made the observation that we've always been passionate about issues. The issues in the 80s and 90s was our own wealth and well-being. So we took on the cause of making a lot of money. And now as we move towards retirement, I'm not sure what we're moving towards, what our issue is going to be, except it's probably to deny the fact that we're growing older and we will be the eternally young generation, I guess.
And what about the Gen Xers? Where will we go? What's next with the Gen Xers? We're raising the plurals, right?
You're raising the plurals for the most part. I think Gen X is going to do fine. The story I tell is baby boomers like to process a lot of stuff. And we like to put newsprint on walls and markers and masking tape. Those were the tools of our trade. And we'd put together this elaborate program of goals and objectives and purpose statements. And then we'd file it in a filing cabinet. And Gen Xers...
We just put it on a computer?
Well, Gen Xers look at us and said, you haven't done anything. And then they go ahead and do it. It was observed that the Nike line, just do it, characterized the Gen Xers. And I think that probably is where they are going. They're not going to get a lot of sympathy from baby boomers. But they're also not just going to sit around waiting for something to be done for them. They're just going to do it.
And so I'm curious how that plays out in parenting styles of these of the plurals. I'm just curious what that's going to look like. And I'm sure that remains to be seen to some degree.
Well, baby boomers, if they do follow through and follow the baby boomer pattern, then that's going to be a part of that relational, communal, everybody gets along together, kumbaya world.
We'll see how that works out.
Yeah, right.
So the next generation, the plurals, with just under a minute left, other strengths of this generation that that you're hopeful about?
Well, I do believe they are consensus builders, and as they become adults, they'll bring that collaborative energy to whatever it is that they do, and it's going to be a collaborative energy that's very inclusive. So they will look at the diversity that's a part of their neighborhoods, and they'll. In my visionary idealist world, they'll bring that neighborhood into their churches and confirmation classes and schools, and they'll create a situation where all the generations, all the folks, get along together.
We've been talking with Reverend Dr. Terry Dittmer, Director of LCMS Youth Ministry. Dr. Dittmer, thanks for being our guest on Faith and Family today, helping us understand this next generation of plurals.
Or maybe you're more confused.
Thanks so much for being our guest.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a little bit, Thy Strong Word. Stick around for more great programming right here on listener-supported worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.